International Edition. I'm Susan Yaki in Washington. Ahead, we look at the U.S. debate of the Iran nuclear deal.
Congress will vote very close on this issue because many of the congressmen will feel that they will be politically punished if they don't vote against it.
Consider the long road to go for normalizing U.S.-Cuban relations. Hear about a Jerusalem park that may help other cities learn how to sustain wildlife in urban settings. And a singer that mixes emotional lyrics with a voice that echoes Amy Winehouse. Coming up right here on The Voice of America. The Iran nuclear agreement continues to be at the top of our news tree today, and VOA's Victor Beatty has the latest on all this and joins us here in the studio. Welcome, Victor.
Hello, Susan. Well, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry, in an interview Tuesday with the Saudi-based Al Arabiya Network, says Saturday's remarks by Iran's Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei were disturbing. He says he's taking them at face value, although such public pronouncements can evolve. The Ayatollah said Iran's opposition to the U.S. would not change, despite the landmark nuclear agreement reached with six world powers. He said U.S. policy differs 180 degrees from that of Tehran in countries like Syria, Iraq, and Yemen. Well, Kerry's remarks came a day after the U.N. Security Council unanimously endorsed the Iran nuclear agreement. It directs the International Atomic Energy Agency to verify and monitor Tehran's compliance. Now, the next hurdle for the deal is the U.S. Congress, which is currently in the midst of a 60-day review period where it could accept or reject the deal. On Monday, White House spokesman Josh Earnest dismissed the view that seeking U.N. endorsement first undermines the forthcoming congressional debate.
The fact is there actually is an extraordinary provision included in the Security Council resolution that was adopted by the Security Council, which is to ensure that the resolution adopted doesn't actually go into effect for another 90 days. And that is specifically to allow Congress ample time to conduct their review of the agreement.
Earnest says only Congress and the President can lift U.S. sanctions on Iran. Well, the U.N. measure carries a mechanism that allows for a snapback of sanctions should it be determined that Iran is violating the agreement. I asked regional analyst Ian Lustig of the University of Pennsylvania if that is realistic.
I think that it is because, again, you've got all the powers who are agreeing on this. I think the snapping back is a meme that has more rhetorical force than what would actually be the case. But I think that if there were serious violations, there would be a reimposition of U.N. sanctions. I think what you would have, of course, is Russia and China having a veto over that. So there would have to be violations of the sort that would actually worry Russia and China.
Some 60 former national security officials, ambassadors, military leaders, former cabinet secretaries here in the U.S. signed a letter supporting the Iran nuclear deal. Will that add pressure on Congress to support it?
Well, I think it will, but I think ultimately Congress will vote very close on this issue because many of the congressmen will feel that they will be politically punished if they don't vote against it and don't think that they'll be rewarded particularly for voting for it. So in a situation like this, what often happens is that congressmen and even senators who would like to vote for the measure but will be most hurt by it will be given the okay by their parties, in this case would be the Democratic Party, to go ahead and vote against it because they know they'll have the minimum votes to either defeat the resolution or to overcome a veto. So I expect very close outcome, but I fully expect it to be supportive in the end of the agreement.
Lustig says he expects Israel's effort to scuttle the deal in Congress will fall short, but he expects Israel to demand more U.S. security concessions as the price for such an agreement. He also says he will be closely watching developments along the Israel-Lebanon border, where Israel fears an emboldened Iranian-backed Hezbollah may strike. Lustig says while the threat of an Israeli attack on Iran's nuclear infrastructure would set Tehran's nuclear program back about 3 years, the international agreement reached would delay its nuclear capabilities to a weapon more than a decade. At the same time, he says the agreement will result in Iran becoming a major regional player, along with Israel, Turkey, and Saudi Arabia.
Thank you very much for that report, Victor.
Thank you, Susan.
Joining me here in the studio is reporter Andrew Palchevsky with a look at what is being said today in social media. Andrew, what's up today?
Well, the top trending name this morning is Yaqub Maimon. He is one of the suspects or convicted in the 1993 Bombay bombings in India. It was India's deadliest bombing attack, killed 257 people with a series of bombs at the Mumbai Stock Exchange hotels. And the announcement this morning is that he's going to be hanged for his crimes on July 30th, which is actually his 53rd birthday. So his name is trending this morning as that decision is coming out in India, people praising that decision, that justice has been served after it's been over 20 years since that bombing. Another name that's trending this morning for happier reasons is Ernest Hemingway. Today would have been his 116th birthday, so people taking to social media to share their favorite Ernest Hemingway novels and passages. The quote that's getting shared a lot this morning is, "There is no friend as loyal as a book," which is one of his big famous quotes. Another thing that's being shared, interestingly, is a six-word short story, "For Sale, Baby Shoes Never Worn." This is called "The Shortest Short Story Ever." The problem is that Ernest Hemingway didn't write it. So as oftentimes on social media, things get attributed to people. Urban legends can kind of percolate up through social media, and this is that case.
He was a very interesting character all around.
He was. A lot of people talking a lot of about his like to imbibe. Also, he was fond of the drink. So people talking about that as well today on social media. That's another thing that's being shared a lot. And another hashtag that's trending this morning, hashtag earthquake. Now, this is interesting. There was a small earthquake, 4.0, outside of Fremont, California, which is not a major earthquake. But the interesting thing is that it struck just a few miles away from the headquarters of Apple, Facebook, Google, right near Silicon Valley. Yes.
Yeah.
So that's why that's a trending topic this morning. People making a lot of jokes about that. Thankfully, it doesn't seem to be any damage, but makes sense why that's a trending topic in social media world today.
That's all those people who are there with their little social media things tweeting about their own experience.
Yeah, absolutely. And it was about 2:30 in the morning in California. So even still, I'm sure people grabbed their phones from their bed and started tweeting right away.
Right.
So.
They tweet in their sleep.
Absolutely, yeah.
Okay, well, thank you, Andrew.
Thank you.
This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
Climate scientists from UCLA and NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory have found that some of the heat generated by greenhouse gases have been trapped and held beneath the surface of the Pacific and Indian Oceans. The researchers suggest that this may explain the decade-long slowdown in the rise of global surface temperatures. They found that a layer located between 91 and 305 meters beneath the surface of the Pacific and Indian Oceans has been gathering more heat than previously observed. According to the researchers, movement of this warm subsurface ocean water has produced an unusually cooler surface, which in turn has also cooled the air temperature above. Scientists said that similar decade or longer breaks in the rise of Earth's average surface temperature also took place in the mid-1940s and the late 1970s. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Monday marked the restoration of U.S.-Cuban relations, but there is much to do to unravel more than a half century of restrictions, as International Edition's Jeffrey Young found out today. Hey, Jeff, thanks for joining me here in the studio.
Hi, Susan. I spoke with Thomas Bilbao. He's the executive director of the Cuba Study Group in Washington. Bilbao says that both the executive branch and Capitol Hill have a lot of laws and regulations to change to reflect the new relationship between the United States and Cuba.
We do, but opening embassies puts us in a position to advance U.S. natural interests on the ground in Cuba. It allows our diplomats to have greater contact with civil society on the ground and with diplomatic missions there, and to work with Cuba on a number of bilateral issues that are of mutual interest, like drug interdiction, oil spill mitigation, and terrorist financing.
Tell me about the work that's going to have to be done on Capitol Hill.
Well, while we opened embassies, we know that the embargo is still in place, and that's because that was codified by Congress, and it takes Congress in order to do away with those sanctions. For example, Americans' ability to travel to Cuba for tourism is something that's explicitly prohibited in law. However, there is legislation to do away with that travel those travel restrictions, and there are other legislation in place to expand telecommunications, to wholesale lift the embargo, or to expand trade in different areas. So it will take Congress moving to do away with those sanctions.
You know, for decades, big developers. They've been looking at Cuba, and they've had big eyes and a big appetite. All they see is Condo Canyon. All they see is development, 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 development. How long do you think it's going to take?
I think that what we should concentrate on doing now is helping Cubans start, operate, and grow their businesses and let them be the authors of their future. And I think the United States and the U.S. business can play an important role. But I think that the future of Cuba should be led by the Cuban people, not by us.
What about laws that have to do with property, with investment, with protecting people's development? Every country has to have laws to protect investments. Are Cuba's laws on the books, presently on the books, strong enough to encourage investment and development, or do they need to be beefed up so that Cuba becomes a more attractive place for outside money?
Well, we've already seen that there are foreign investors in Cuba, and Cuba, in fact, redid its foreign investment law last year to try to attract new businesses, and it did attract some, but I think that a lot of companies still have very legitimate concerns, including the ability to hire and manage their own staff, to be able to pay their staff directly, a number of labor concerns, and concerns regarding property and the protection of intellectual property and other things that really will have to be resolved if Cuba hopes to attract the type of foreign investment that it needs to grow its economy to be able to be competitive in the 21st century.
That was Thomas Bilbao, Executive Director of the Cuba Study Group in Washington.
Thanks, Jeffrey, for that report.
Glad to be of help.
The restoring of full U.S.-Cuban relations has some business owners biting at the bit. Joining us on the line is reporter Alexis Christophorus in New York. Hi, Alexis.
Hi, Susan. Thank you. That's right. From internet service providers to U.S. banks, an array of industries stand to benefit from free trade and travel between the U.S. and Cuba. But companies involved in tourism really could be among the biggest winners. We're talking about American cruise lines that will stop in Havana and airlines such as Delta and American Airlines, which has long had a major operation in Miami. Also, telecommunications companies will now be able to create infrastructure in Cuba that will open up a communication pipeline between that country and the U.S. It's reported that only about 5% of Cubans have access to the open internet. And, of course, U.S. farmers see a big opportunity here. Cubans apparently crave Louisiana agriculture products, especially the Bayou State's rice. And officials say Louisiana is perfectly positioned to cash in on trade with Cuba because of its close proximity to Louisiana ports. Louisiana can get rice to Cuba cheaper than just about anybody else, so that would translate to a premium for Louisiana farmers. And, of course, American car companies are eager to make inroads in Cuba. Ford and General Motors tremendous opportunities there. And Cuba could even be a destination for a car company that wants to assemble vehicles from kits, essentially crates of parts that are shipped to a factory simply to be put together. So the possibilities appear to be endless, Susan.
Well, thank you, Alexis, for that business update from New York.
You bet.
Coming up on International Edition, environmentalists take credit for a win in Jerusalem, and a singer who has made a splash in Britain. Israeli environmentalists say a new Jerusalem nature park they recently created can help other cities and countries learn how to sustain wildlife in urban settings. Gazelle Valley Park opened in late March in the western part of Jerusalem, surrounded by residential neighborhoods and highways. It's home to endangered mountain gazelles, reptiles, and birds. International Edition's Michael Lippin recently visited the park and spoke to activists who fought an almost two-decade-long battle to establish it. The battle began with defeating a plan by property companies to redevelop the area. It ended with the activists securing municipal approval and funding to preserve the valley as a nature park. One of the activists he spoke with was Amir Balaban of the Society for the Protection of Nature in Israel.
We have to enhance nature, and in order to do so, we're involved in a few very important stages. The first one is to create a national database of urban wildlife in all Israeli cities. The second one is to create master plans of urban wildlife sites and urban wildlife in cities all over Israel, and we're doing this in cooperation with the Ministry of Environment. The third aspect is the physical aspect, creating these natural anchors in each town a network of urban wildlife sites that, first of all, protect local biodiversity, second, enhance them and use the biodiversity services that they supply, and the third element is education and community. Using nature to create strong community, healthy communities, people who care about their environment. So Gazelle Valley Park is the largest project that we have been involved in Israel's history. If this succeeds, there will be many more. If we fail, it might be the last one. Now, looking around us, there's a lot of urban wildlife in other countries around us. In Cairo, the magnificent Nile passes through Egypt's capital. In Baghdad, it's the Euphrates. It's an immense force. Now, we have a lot to benefit in these cities from wildlife and working with nature. And one of the amazing things we see here in Israel, and we'll see it when we walk and stroll in the park, you will see people from very different backgrounds spending time patiently in one place. You'll see ultra-religious people, and you'll see ultra-secular people and Arabs just enjoying nature, doing their own thing, but with a lot of patience. So maybe I'm naive, but I believe that nature is very soothing, and it's the best common denominator. And I'm not the only one. One of the first urban wildlife sites created in Israel, the Jerusalem Bird Observatory, which is by the Israeli parliament, held the first ringing course for Palestinian, Jordanian, and Israelis together. So there might be a startup here. And we did this with the help of Merck, USAID, which identified as a potentially powerful tool to bring people together and focus on the really important. So I'm a strong believer that it's not only an important thing for cities, it's very important for people in this region.
Israeli environmentalist Amir Balaban. You can find a video version of this story at voanews.com, along with a more detailed web story about what makes the park unique. You're tuned to VOA.
This is Greenbee for a healthier planet.
The bees at the Fairmont Waterfront Hotel are welcome guests. But unlike the other guests at this Vancouver resort, the bees didn't come to relax. They make honey and help pollinate the hotel's large herb garden. Bee butler Michael King is enthusiastic about his charges because of their capability to pollinate most of the world's agriculture.
Their ability to navigate, their ability to feed themselves, their ability to feed us as a result of what they do.
The Fairmont Waterfront Hotel is a green hotel, certified by Green Key Global, an environmental group that specializes in the hotel industry. There is complimentary parking for electric vehicles, and guests are served the honey produced on site. The hotel also promotes sustainability with its rooftop garden, which helps save rainwater and insulates the interior of the building. The hotel says it's on a mission to be certified zero waste by the end of next year through reusing, repurposing, and recycling. I'm Rebecca Ward for VOA's Green Beat.
British singer Hannah Boleyn is about to release her first CD after making a splash in Britain. As International Edition's David Byrd tells us, Boleyn's CD, The Boleyn Affair, mixes emotional lyrics with a singer whose voice echoes other British stars, Adelaide and Amy Winehouse.
Wrap me up in your arms, read the future in my bond. Tell me if we'll work out. My body is riddled with doubt.
Hannah Boleyn says she is fond of music she calls cinematic soul. Think the theme from Goldfinger or The Spy Who Loved Me. Big arrangements, big voices, female voices that showcase big emotions. The 25-year-old from Leicestershire, England, started her first band when she was in elementary school. Obsessed with the Spice Girls, her favorite one being Posh Spice, also known as Victoria Beckham, she formed a girl group of her own and performed original material for her classmates. Boleyn left home at 16 to go to a musical theater school, but found she didn't want to do other people's music her whole life. As her career path came into sharper focus, Hannah decided to record as an independent artist. something that has made her rise to success tougher.
I've had lots of friends and family, when you tell someone you're a singer, and they go, oh, got the X Factor. But for me, firstly, I love the writing process. That's a big part of it for me, and I want to have control of what I'm doing. And secondly, I don't think anyone would like me. So I wouldn't get any votes.
But she is getting noticed. After years of gigging with whoever would take her, Boleyn has found success supporting artists, including James Morrison, Joan Armatrading, and Tini Tempa. In working on her debut CD, Boleyn worked with Ash Howes, who's worked with Ellie Goulding, One Direction, and Olly Murs. She also worked with Paul Berry, the writer responsible for Cher's Believe, as well as hits for Rod Stewart, Enrique Iglesias, and others. But her single, Tough Love, is about how difficult it has been as an independent artist, particularly as a woman.
It has been, and continues to be, a massive challenge, but I'm really lucky that I'm now working with some incredible people, and you rely on those people to bring you back up when you're feeling down, and vice versa. So I feel like I'm getting there. Fingers crossed.
Many of Boleyn's songs, including her first single, When You're Gone, are about romance, love, and relationships. She says she loves the emotion of music, so things that spark her emotions inspire many of her tunes.
I'm really influenced by relationships and trying to put a different spin on things as well, looking at things from someone else's perspective.
Tough Love is the second single from Boleyn's debut CD, The Boleyn Affair, which is scheduled for release from Tudor Gate Records in October. I'm David Byrd.
We'd like to invite you to follow us on Twitter. You can find us at @VOA_IE. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Mozambique took a welcome and public stand against wildlife trafficking this month by destroying 2.4 tons of elephant ivory and 86 pieces of rhino horn, weighing more than 420 pounds. U.S. Embassy staff were among those present at the event and issued a statement applauding the bold action by the government of Mozambique in the destruction of confiscated stockpiles. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service also issued a statement on July 10th, adding, "We are hopeful that this signifies a renewed commitment to combat poaching and wildlife trafficking." Mozambique represents the 10th country to engage in destruction of confiscated illegal ivory since the service held its first ivory crush in November 2013. Rampant poaching is taking its toll within Mozambique and on neighboring countries. Mozambique has lost 48% of its elephants in just the past 5 years. Recent surveys revealed that there are only 10,300 elephants left in the country. To the west of Mozambique, rhino poaching in South Africa skyrocketed from 7 rhinos poached in 2000 to 1,215 rhinos poached in 2014. Poaching also affects the rangers who put their lives on the line to defend these magnificent animals. Mozambique has experienced a number of significant thefts of seized ivory and rhino horn, and the United States recognizes the merit of destroying this stockpile, not only to signal how seriously Mozambique is taking this issue, but also to prevent any potential reentry of these confiscated items into illegal trade. The government of Mozambique's decision to publicly destroy their confiscated ivory and rhino horn sends a clear message that poaching and wildlife trafficking will no longer be tolerated. The United States is committed to working with its partner, Mozambique, to stop a trade which threatens rhinos and elephants with extinction.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.